him there, hoping soon he'd die. That his body and spirit would waste away, and soon after that his mind. But every day he's born a fool, one who thinks that he can rule, one who says tomorrow's mine, one who wakes one day to find prison doors open, the shackles broken, and chaos in the street. Everybody sing with free, 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 free. Everybody sing with free, 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 free. Everybody sing with free, 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 free. Oh, they throw him in jail and they kept him there, hoping his memory died. Let the people forget how he once led, fought for justice in their lives. Every day, born a man, hates what he can't understand. Thinks the answer is to kill. Thinks his actions are God's will. And he thinks he's free, free, free. Yes, he thinks he's free, 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 free. Oh, he thinks he's free, 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 free. Soon must come the day, oh, when the righteous have their way, just to try to free. Oh, can people live in peace, I say, give the man release. Oh, go on and set your conscience free, right the wrongs you made. Oh, even a fool can have his day. Let us all be free, 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 free. Let us all be free, 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 free. Let us all be free, 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 free. For everyone, freedom now. Oh, freedom now. Freedom now. Freedom now. Let us all be free, 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 free. Let us all be free, 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 free. Let us all be free, 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 free. Let us all be free. Let us all be. Let us all be free. Let us all be. Let us all be free.
That was Freedom Now by Tracy Chapman.
A new feature on Making Waves in 2006, we now bring you Extreme News. News too true to be true. Today's report is on a new element found. The recent hurricanes and skyrocketing oil and gasoline prices helped to prove the existence of a new element. In early October 2005, a major research institution announced the discovery of the heaviest element yet known to science. The new element has been named governmentium. Governmentium, GV, has 1 neutron, 25 assistant neutrons, 88 deputy neutrons, and 198 assistant deputy neutrons, giving it an atomic mass of 312. These 312 particles are held together by forces called morons, which are surrounded by vast quantities of lepton-like particles called pions. Since GV has no electrons, it is inert. However, it can be detected because it impedes every reaction with which it comes into contact. A minute amount of GV causes one reaction to take over 4 days to complete when it would normally take less than a second. GV has a normal half-life of 4 years. It does not decay, but instead undergoes a reorganization in which a portion of the assistant neutrons and deputy neutrons exchange places. In fact, governmentium's mass will actually increase over time, since each reorganization will cause more morons to become neutrons, forming isotopes. This characteristic of moron promotion leads most scientists to believe that GV is formed whenever morons reach a certain quantity in concentration. This hypothetical quantity is referred to as critical morass. When catalyzed with money, GV becomes administratium, an element which radiates just as much energy as GV, since it has half as many peons, but twice as many morons. That extreme news too true to be true segment, came from the internet, source unknown.
Next we have an article by Mazen Kumsia, called Of Sharon, Arafat, Abramoff, and the Media. The text of the article, with more links, can be found at www.kumsieh.org. More than a year ago, many in the U.S. media focused on how the passing of an ailing Arafat would become the key to unlocking the deadlocked peace process. We now know this is untrue or was vastly exaggerated. There was hardly any U.S. coverage of the nature of his mysterious illness. To date, there was no diagnosis. There was hardly any coverage of the good wishes he received from leaders around the world. Nor was there balanced discussion of his history or even of his Israeli supporters or his Palestinian critics. Only Israeli critics were highlighted. Now Sharon is ailing, and the contrast in some coverage could not be any more dramatically different. The double standard goes deeper and perhaps relates to the wider problem of U.S. foreign policy credibility around the world. Arafat, while derided as an obstacle to peace and for cronyism, was imprisoned in his compound in Ramallah by Israeli forces that controlled even his access to food and water. Arafat was actually challenged by nearly half of the Palestinian people for moving away, starting in the 1970s and culminating in Oslo in the 1990s, from national liberation to unbalanced and unfair negotiations leading to agreements that failed to protect Palestinian human rights as codified by international law. Sharon sat as a leader of the fourth or fifth strongest military power in the world, with extensive weapons of mass destruction and significant violations of international law. But Sharon was also responsible for massacres at Kubya in 1953, at Gaza in 1971, at Sabra and Shatila in 1982, and more recently for large-scale demolition of Palestinian homes and for targeting civilians. See reports by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights, and Israeli human rights organizations like B'Tselem. He was even held personally responsible for Sabra and Shatila massacres by Israeli's own investigative commission. More recently, legal proceedings were brought against him under Belgium's universal jurisdiction laws, and huge pressure from Israeli and U.S. governments were put on the judiciary in Belgium to drop the case. Most of the world understood that the major obstacle to peace is Israeli colonization and oppression of native Palestinians in contravention of international law and over 60 UN Security Council resolutions. Most of the world also recognizes that the support by the U.S. government to Israel was critical in its evasion of international law, for instance about the need to let Palestinian refugees return to their homes and lands. This support was buttressed by the influence of the Israeli lobby in D.C. and in some media outlets. Most of the world knows it is mere distractions and delays, the approach of peace to personalize issues around Arafat or Sharon, to focus on the violence of those resisting occupation and colonization, but not the violence of the occupier or colonizer, and to speak of unilateral solutions that involve walls and Bantustans as advancing peace. Such distractions were attempted in apartheid South Africa and failed. Yet many in the U.S. media persist in trying to use these fig leaves. It is not easy to understand who benefits from vilifying Arafat and making Sharon's policies of dictating unilateral solutions look good. Why would one discuss the withdrawal of Israeli troops and settlers from Gaza without explaining that, per international law, Gaza remains occupied, or that in exchange for withdrawing the 2% of total settlers from Gaza, Sharon added 4% settlers in the West Bank? One can understand the media's concern for the health of an Israeli prime minister, but what should never be excused is shabby journalism and hypocrisy in covering illnesses of leaders like Arafat versus Sharon. Perhaps other affairs give more hints to these double standards. Going back, one could cite the dubious reasons for invading Iraq while supporting Israel. Israel was, and continues to be, in violation of 10 times more UN resolutions than Iraq ever was. More recently, the Abramoff affair may also shed some light, and may be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Abramoff pleaded guilty to defrauding Native American tribes of millions and directing the money through fake charities to gain political influence and to help his pet causes. But why is it that many in the U.S. media, with few brave exceptions, failed to mention that his top cause and his passion was Israeli colonization of Palestinian lands? Abramoff, for example, diverted money, so-called charitable donations, to Israeli settlers living illegally on Palestinian lands. His customers were told his money is intended for inner-city poor Americans. Instead, the money bought military hardware to help settlers terrorize native Palestinians. Ironically, Native Americans were defrauded into funding oppression and colonization of other native people. Abramoff also used his influence with Congressman Bob Nye to get a government contract worth $3 million to an obscure Israeli security company, and on and on. But why is this information not being highlighted or even mentioned on the pages of major newspapers or discussed in TV programs? Could it be that this could harm the special relationship between the U.S. and Israeli governments that is so well guarded and now so detrimental to U.S. public interests? After all, even if one accepts the ludicrous suggestion that Israel is a democracy, why should we give Israel, 0.1% of the world's population, more money and resources and vetoes at the UN Security Council than Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and Central America combined? Why should U.S. taxpayers give more federal aid to Israel per capita than many states in the U.S.? One can only be thankful that we have an international mainstream media, some courageous U.S. media outlets that publish such information, and the Internet. Dare we hope that 2006 will be a pivotal year when the avalanche of information and public activism becomes so large that the fig leaves of misinformation, diversions, and double standards will be swept aside.
That was commentary by Mazen Kumsia, a Palestinian-American and former professor of genetics at Yale University School of Medicine. Mazen is the author of the widely acclaimed book Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. Dr. Kumsia's specialty is media activism. He has published over 120 letters to the editor, 50 op-ed pieces, and has been interviewed on TV and radio extensively. Read by Steve Diamond.
My daddy was an heir from Beersheba, a situation so unkind. My mama was a refugee from Ramallah, had to leave her land behind. I grew up in this refugee camp, in this unwelcome land. In this little parcel of Lebanon, we were dealt a losing hand. And then one day the soldiers came, a tired old refrain. I'll try to tell you what happened next, but there's no way to explain. The soldiers raped my mother, and they killed her dead, along with the rest of the Shatila camp, while I hid beneath my bed. Now I'm a wandering, no place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam. Came over from Jordan, brought me there to live, and together we've moved to half the world for peace, what I would give. Beirut, Greece, and New York town, I've watched the world churn, but my home is Palestine, someday I will return. But I'm a wanderer, place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam. This is my situation here in the heart of the empire that sent the copters and bulldozers from Obama to a funeral pyre. You've heard my story. Time will not allow. Soon my visa will expire. What will you do now? 'Cause I'm a wanderer, no place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam.
That was David Rovics with Palestine. Here's a poem for you now from The Simple Fears called The Civilized World.
How goes the war on terror, George? Is Al-Qaeda under control? Does the world know peace, freedom and justice? I think I'd say no on the whole. In the days after 9/11, the goodwill of the world was yours. I might have opened a dialogue. I might have pondered the cause. I might have considered the issues, asked what the solutions might be. Beating the crap out of everybody never occurred to me. But justice had to be done. George, you made that attack. I think most of them were Saudis. Let's invade Iraq. They showed no respect for the United Nations. They had only contempt for that forum. You can't keep ignoring the UN like they did. We showed them how to ignore them. But now Iraq's turned against us. I suppose it's what you'd expect. Beating the crap out of everybody tends to have that effect. There were links with Al-Qaeda, you said. Iraq. Not a chance, we said, never. But thanks to your tactical awareness, George, you might just have pushed them together. Remember the day the war ended? George, it just seems to drag on. But we're going to liberate these people if we have to kill every last one. How shall we win hearts and minds? Don't tell me, George, I think I know. Beating the out of everybody. I think we should give that a go. Bomb the hospital, shoot the ambulance driver, knock the neighbourhood flat. It's a good job they aren't real people. You can't treat real people like that. Why not stop selling arms around the world? Change the whole scheme of world trade. Take a fresh look at Israel and Palestine. It's not what you want, I'm afraid. We could build a new world based on justice. Do things according to law. Beating the crap out of everybody? It hasn't solved problems before. How goes the war on terror, George? It's a war, George. Can anyone win? The world needs peace, freedom and justice. It's a long road, but why not begin?
That was The Civilized World by The Simple Fears. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. Now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Norman Solomon, who examines U.S. media coverage of critical aspects of the National Security Agency domestic surveillance scandal. Jeff Vogt of the Washington Office on Latin America, who assesses the historic election of Evo Morales as Bolivia's president and the many challenges he'll face. and attorney Bill Quigley, who describes his work on behalf of a coalition of New Orleans homeowners that has succeeded in temporarily blocking the demolition of thousands of homes in the hurricane-ravaged city. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Adli Yaish, the new pro-Hamas mayor of Nablus on the West Bank, knows he has a tough job. The city is an economic basket case with rising unemployment and restrictive border crossings run by the Israeli army. Rival Palestinian militias easily recruit young people here. With a reputation for honesty, pro-Islamic politicians like Yaish swept recent Palestinian municipal elections and are expected to do well in upcoming legislative elections against the ruling Fatah faction of President Mahmoud Abbas. As Fatah's organizer in Nablus, Ghassan Shaka explained, "It's a benefit for Hamas to be in the municipality or the parliament. They have to act as a political party, not only a resistance party." Meanwhile, young mothers with children and the elderly have to wait for hours to get past Israeli checkpoints. The Israeli army says tight security at the checkpoints stops the flow of weapons to militias and protects Israeli cities from terror attacks. On New Year's Day 2005, over 500 organizations and celebrities launched the Make Poverty History campaign. The effort led to mass protests and big benefit concerts. However, some agencies openly wonder if any real progress against poverty was made. According to the London-based independent newspaper, pop star Bob Geldof was coming under fire for his role in the campaign. After the G8 summit in July, Geldof praised Tony Blair for providing a 10 out of 10 on debt issues, although as yet no detailed plan has been released to provide debt relief to poor nations. As Dave Timms of the World Development Movement stated, "There are celebrities who don't seem to know what they are talking about, and Geldof's comments after the G8 were unhelpful because they made people think everything had been achieved." More than 15 million people in Britain bought white armbands to support the Make Poverty History campaign. As Timms of the World Development Movement concluded, "As for what happens between 2008 and 2010, the U.S. is openly doubting the feasibility of its aid commitment, while German and Italian finance ministers have said they do not regard the target of doubling poverty aid by 2010 as binding." In early 2005, Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum praised his state's Dover Area School District for attempting to teach the controversy of evolution and embracing the so-called intelligent design theory. But the conservative Republican, in a tough re-election fight over time, has changed his tune. This has come into more focus after U.S. District Judge John E. Jones ruled the teaching of intelligent design was unconstitutional. In an interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer, Santorum criticized the Dover School Board, which was ousted in November's local election, for pushing too hard on intelligent design. Santorum has been on the advisory board of the Thomas More Center, the Christian-based public interest group that defended the Dover School Board in the lawsuit. Now, Santorum plans to leave the advisory board. In 2001, Santorum sponsored an amendment to the No Child Left Behind education law, encouraging school districts to teach the controversy about evolution. The amendment first passed the U.S. Senate on a 91-8 vote, but was later dropped in the final version of the bill. Pro-science groups strongly opposed the Santorum amendment. In a 2002 op-ed in the Moon-owned Washington Times, Santorum wrote, "Intelligent design is a legitimate scientific theory that should be taught in science classes." Santorum's likely opponent in November, State Treasurer Bob Casey, a moderate Democrat, accused the conservative senator of having an election year conversion on intelligent design and accused Santorum of promoting the politics of division in the U.S. Senate. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
New information about the National Security Agency's surveillance of American citizens, authorized by President Bush without required court warrants, has surfaced indicating that Attorney General John Ashcroft's deputy James Comey reportedly objected to the program. However, it seems whatever objections may have been raised by top officials did not stop NSA spying on international communications involving U.S. citizens and residents. News reports have also revealed that the NSA regularly shared information gathered from its monitoring of phone calls and email with other national intelligence agencies engaged in anti-terrorism operations, such as the FBI, CIA, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. But information about peace activists engaged in legal protest against the Iraq War were found in a covert government database last month, when the NSA was found to have spied on lawful political activists during the 1960s and 70s, Congress passed a law creating the Foreign Intelligence Security Courts, the very system that the Bush administration has now bypassed. Although the NSA was found to have illegally spied on United Nations delegations during the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, and the New York Times had knowledge about the current domestic surveillance program a year ago, American media outlets did little with this story until December 2005. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with author and syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, who examines the failure of the U.S. corporate media to aggressively report on the NSA scandal over the last several years.
Many ways, the journalism is like justice. If it's delayed, it's denied. And journalism gains a lot of its power from being timely. That's why the delay of this story for more than, quote unquote, a year, which is what the New York Times initially acknowledged, is very important. It was delayed for more than a year, since before the 2004 election for president. And I think that that is part of the bittersweet reality of this story. It's an important one. It is causing huge political effects in this country. But the fact that it was delayed for so long really says a lot about the mass media elite culture of this country.
Tell us a little bit about your reaction to the Times' justification for holding that story back. They weren't specific, but they did say they met with President Bush in the Oval Office, and they were asked to delay the story. You know, the intimation is that the Times held the story up to protect something related to national security. Do you buy that?
Well, it's all very vague in terms of what the Times is doing. I mean, by way of background, I think the assumption that is very common in the country that the chief executive of the U.S. government, which is to say the president, should be given the benefit of the doubts and should be trusted to make basically wise decisions is paralleled in the journalistic profession quite often and in the country at large, with the idea that the executive editor of an outlet like the New York Times should also be given the benefit of the doubt, and we assume that he had just and sufficient reasons to make this or that decision. We don't know what those reasons were. I mean, we've been told that they needed to do additional reporting, but we also have been told that the story was in hand before people went to the polls and voted for the presidential race in November 2004. And also we are told by the Times that they were recipient of concern from the Bush administration about, quote-unquote, national security implications of publishing the story. And yet, ultimately, Bush still did not want them to publish the story, and they went ahead and did so. It all comes down to self-censorship with a very strong push from the White House for that self-censorship to be implemented. It has a very bad smell, and once media outlets hold information that they have and make the judgment that the public shouldn't and can't handle the information, shouldn't be told the information, then you get into a situation where if the story is finally published, people ask, well, why then? You know, hours before the scheduled vote in the Senate on the Patriot Act. So then the right wing says, well, gee, how come you timed it then? Well, you know, the best timing is being timely. And by that standard, the New York Times was about 14 months too late.
Norman, I wanted to ask you about 30 more or more years ago, Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. Couldn't get it published for a while, but eventually the New York Times did publish it. I believe it was 1971. You wrote about this recently in discussing these issues of press repression of some of these important stories. What do you think has changed from that era during the Vietnam War when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers and the New York Times did take some risks in publishing it? What's changed in our media, do you think, in the intervening years?
Well, one aspect is that these media companies are a lot larger. The ones that have survived and merged and gained more media consolidation. There's a lot more riding on them. Less often are they simply concerned about the profit margin for a particular family. There are investors. Maybe it's publicly traded. It probably is. It may be divided into A and B stock. So in the case of, for instance, the Washington Post, the family still retains control. But it's part of the corporate system. And these media outlets are inclined to take fewer risks for anything that approaches journalistic principle. I mean, there was a lot of dodging of responsibility and evasion during the Vietnam War, and it took Seymour Hersh a very long time before he could get the My Lai massacre story out, for instance. It was declined by major media outlets. It had to go out through a news service that he co-founded. And we also had a lot of reticence to report on the lies that were, in fact, propelling the continuation of the Vietnam War. But, you know, the proof is kind of in the pudding. And frankly, I'm not so sure that if someone such as Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers today, that they would necessarily appear in the New York Times or the Washington Post, or perhaps they would have waited at the New York Times 14 months. Well, they didn't wait 14 months in 1971, but that seems to be more of the caution that's involved today, even in the so-called liberal media.
That was Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Read Solomon's columns online at www.warmadeeasy.com. After years of political conflict, Bolivia joined a growing progressive wave sweeping South America when Evo Morales, an Indian activist and advocate for the poor, was elected president on December 18th. Morales, who as leader of the Movement Towards Socialism or MAS party, led protests that forced two presidents from power over the past 4 years, will take office on January 22nd. The nation's first indigenous president won with an unprecedented 54% of the vote in an election where turnout was an estimated 85%. Bolivia's poor farmers and majority indigenous population enthusiastically supported Morales and his campaign, promising to maximize state revenues from energy resources, fight for Indian rights, and legalize some local cultivation of the coca crop. Morales' post-election visit with Fidel Castro in Cuba and his close relationship with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez have underscored the Bush administration's frustration about the rise of another popular leftist leader opposed to Washington's economic policies. After Morales' election, 80% of South America's population now live under left or center-left governments. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Jeff Vogt, Senior Associate for Rights and Development with the Washington Office on Latin America, who assesses the historic election of Evo Morales and the many challenges he'll face.
What the MAS represents and what the kind of platform of this government is looking for, really kind of reinserting the state as an actor in the politics and the economy of the country in such a way that the last 20 or so years, the state has been kind of systematically corrupted from within, dismantled, and withdrawn from the market as an economic force within the country. So that you saw more privatization, more the neoliberalism being adopted as a model wholesale without much of anything to show for it after 20 years of following and being good students of the model, which again I think is why MAS swept into office, or will sweep in office on January 22nd with such a mandate for kind of reform. I mean, additionally, what I think will probably be the biggest point of concern between the U.S. and Bolivia is on the issue of coca, Evo Morales getting his formation in being a union leader of coca farmers and trying to protect what is seen as a traditional use of coca as a plant, taking a firm line against cocaine as the drug. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a recognition of that division among U.S. policymakers and have seen for the longest time and probably continue to see the coca used for traditional use as a threat. The platform of the MAS government is coca si, cocaína no. I mean, there's a very clear division and there's a clear understanding that coca has been used as a traditional remedy for everything from altitude sickness to headaches and so forth for thousands of years. They see more as the cocaine being more of a demand issue that needs to be addressed in the countries that are demanding cocaine and allowing the producing countries, such as Bolivia, to produce a small quantity that is used solely for domestic consumption.
As far as the issue of energy in Bolivia, it's been quite volatile. We're at least two recent presidents were thrown out of office by popular uprisings, upset, very upset about the lack of progress on giving average Bolivians a stake and some sense of revenue stream from the natural resources of the country, mainly natural gas and oil.
Yeah, I mean, that is going to be a difficult issue for this government, but it will be interesting. And I think you have economists like Stiglitz coming out and saying, well, I think it's a legitimate platform and it is workable. Yeah, I think it's important to note that Mas and Evo in particular has kind of been in a, kind of the center of the kind of the struggle on this issue. And I think that's something that's been lost in all of this. On the kind of the most extreme to one side is a complete nationalization, actually, and an expropriation of the wellheads, the means of transportation and refineries. Then you have the Mas position, which is one in which the state will be a much larger actor. And I think if you talk to folks in the MAS, they're looking at other models like Petrobras in Brazil and others in figuring out a way to allow the state to, as far as the extraction of oil, to be a much larger actor and demand the purchase of all the oil and gas that's being extracted while allowing national or international companies to actually do the work, be guaranteed a return on their investment, but allowing the state to actually market and sell and manage the gas and oil. And then with transportation, buying in, controlling shares of those companies, and in some cases in refineries, if refineries are not willing to move towards different contracts, maybe the possibility of expropriating some of those refineries. But Petrobras, which is by far the most important player in Bolivia, is already negotiating and trying to work out something with the new government.
Well, just a final question for you, Jeff, and that is, how do you see Bolivia's election of Evo Morales and the movement towards socialism there with the progressive political movement sweeping Latin America? What role do you think Evo Morales will play in that movement?
I mean, I think a key one. I mean, the vast majority of states in South America now have moved to maybe, it's been called a pink tide, this kind of center-left to left government center. A response to decades of kind of U.S.-backed economic policy, which have not shown really any serious results in the region, with a very few exceptions. You look at reports coming out of UN or the ILO, there's still very high levels of unemployment. The informal sector is the largest sector, economic active sector in many of the countries. And so there's a real kind of wake-ups. We've been down this road. This is what the result has been. More income inequality, little growth which translates into jobs or decent wages for the majority of the population. So, I mean, I think you saw this also at the Summit of the Americas in Argentina in November of last year. The Bush administration coming down to Argentina with its panacea, the free trade area of the Americas, which was supposed to alleviate all the problems of, unemployment and poverty. And, quite a round rejection from the Mercosur countries, from Venezuela and from Bolivia, looking for a different way. And I think, Bolivia will play a role in participating in that dialogue and constructing a new path.
Will there be any special relationship, you think, with Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela?
I mean, it's clear that there is. I mean, they're friendly. They kind of share similar ideas on certain things. I wouldn't go so far as to say, as you hear many commentators and mainstream news saying that there's as if there's some kind of direct line from Caracas or Havana to La Paz as far as kind of policy. Yeah, I think they're going to be in dialogue, and I think they'll certainly share ideas. But I think the reasons that brought Evo to power are very local to Bolivia, very particular to Bolivian conditions, Bolivian history. So just to say that this is somehow a this is something orchestrated by kind of Cuba or Venezuela to horribly misread the situation.
That was Jeff Vogt, Senior Associate for Rights and Development with the Washington Office on Latin America. Contact the group by calling area code 202-797-2171 or visit their website at www.wola.org. More than 4 months after the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans has barely begun to recover. 80% of the city was flooded, and in many neighborhoods, the housing stock was severely damaged, if not utterly destroyed. Mayor Ray Nagin wants to clear the land on which 5,500 homes once stood, most in the lower Ninth Ward. But that move has been put on hold after a judge granted a temporary restraining order to several organizations that went to court on behalf of those mostly still absent homeowners. The city of New Orleans was prevented from bulldozing and demolishing these properties until a full hearing was held on January 6th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Bill Quigley, a professor at Loyola Law School in New Orleans. He was one of several lawyers representing the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, Louisiana Acorn, and other groups that sued to stop the demolition. Quigley describes the homeowners' rights that he believes are being violated and what the city could do to ensure those rights are protected.
We went to the court to prevent the city from destroying people's property without at least consulting with the property owners. In many cases, the properties that they're talking about are actually, you know, houses that will have to come down. But there are some cases in that 5,500 where people have actually started rehabilitating their houses. And it's important, we think, for the city to make a house-by-house determination and to include the owners of the houses in that determination. In many cases, these are people who've lived in these homes for 50 years or more. Many of the homes are in places that they've only recently been allowed to even come back to view. And so we just think that the due process rights that are in the U.S. Constitution and the Louisiana Constitution, which says the government cannot take life, liberty, or property without due process of law, involves notification of the owner that they intend to do it. Number one, to respect the rights of people who are there. Number two, to prevent mistakes so that there aren't properties on the list that people are actually already rehabilitating. And number three, that involving the people of the city in the process of reconstruction and rehabilitation of the city is key to any sort of just rebuilding of our city.
So in this case, is this an expanded use of eminent domain? And has the city or any other entity said what it wants to do with the land once it's cleared?
Eminent domain is where the government decides that they have a different use for your property than you have, and they go ahead and say, we want to put a highway, we want to put a levee, we want to put industrial park, we want to, you know, put a, unfortunately now even like a shopping center or an apartment complex on your property. And we think it's in the community good that we do that. But even in eminent domain, the people who live there, the government has to go through the courts to do that. They file suit against the people who do not want to consent to that. There's a hearing before a judge where they determine if it's a public purpose or not to do that. And then you have a right to have a lawyer and appeal and all that. In this case, there are lots and lots of discussions about how New Orleans should be reshaped. But absent from those discussions is the voice of the people whose property is directly impacted. At this point, they're not even saying that what they're going to do with the property. They're just saying, we're going to tear your property down and clean it off because we need to have more access to these neighborhoods and the like, and we consider them to be a safety hazard. Many of these houses are, in fact, safety hazards, but again, the city has refused to reach out to the homeowners at all to even advise them of what they're doing, saying that they don't have to do that, and if they do that, it'll slow the process down. We say, yes, it will slow the process down, but again, it's important enough to do that.
But where are the homeowners? Many of them aren't back in the city yet, and of the ones who are, most of them can't be staying in their homes. these homes that are in danger of demolition. So how can the city find them to tell them about its demolition plans?
The city could, at a minimum, put a sticker on this house, say we're going to destroy this house in a week. They could run the addresses in the newspaper. They could put those things on the city's website. They could start to get the word out to let people know what is happening. As of right now, the city has not told one of these 5,500 people whether they're going to demolish their homes in the next 2 weeks or not. They're just saying we have the right to do it, and we're just telling people that we're getting ready to start. People can be found, particularly if the city is working with FEMA directly on this. FEMA is paying for all these demolitions. FEMA knows where every single person is because they have been in contact with people to provide them emergency services and the like. There are ways to find people if people want to find them.
Bill Quigley, just run down what the outcome would be depending on which way the judge rules in this case.
If the judge rules against us, then the city and FEMA will begin to fire up the bulldozers and start getting the dump trucks and go through these neighborhoods, knocking down what's left of houses, scooping them up, putting them in dump trucks, and taking them to the dump. If we win, what will happen is that the city will be required to do some sort of notice to people. They're not going to have to file suit against every single one of these people and, you know, take months and months to do it, but they are going to have to give some sort of notice. You know, the city has made a decision they're going to go forward with Mardi Gras, for example. If we can put on a huge extravaganza like Mardi Gras, then we can take the time to let somebody know that their house that they've lived in for 50 years is going to be demolished and hauled away in a dump truck.
That was attorney Bill Quigley, who was representing New Orleans homeowners in their effort to have a voice in what happens to their damaged homes and properties. Contact the People's Hurricane Relief Fund by calling 888-310-7473 or visit their website at www.communitylaborunited.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation, too. Email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Also remember that WSEA is growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and to learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. In the meantime, we leave you with this quote by Friedrich Nietzsche. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster.